Hello and welcome to Q&A 48. Can you believe it has been 48 of these? That's somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 years.
That's about how long except we've been doing the show.
Yeah, sometimes we skip months. How's it going, Andrew? You're back.
I am.
Old Punch Central headquarters.
I am back on solid ground, and I couldn't be happier. I'm nervous about tonight. I guess we will know relatively soon what's going on in Virginia. I assume folks in the chat will keep us updated. Yeah. I have MSNBC on in the background, and it says too early to call, which, you know, usually, but I think they changed the definition of that. That used to be, it was outside the margin of error, but they didn't have enough returns in. But who the hell knows what it is now? But how are you doing?
Oh man, this is I'm not set up at all for this. It's a miracle that I could be on video. it was weird. The normal camera I use, because I don't have any lighting up, it had two options: totally dark or like I'm an X-Files alien, bright. That was the only. There was no in between. So I was like, well, so now I'm using my onboard camera. It seems to be okay, but
you look anyway. Great. You look fantastic.
I don't. All right. Let's get to the questions. And I only have one screen. That's the biggest problem. I have one screen now, Andrew.
Oh,
one
well, screen. That's, yeah. That,
I'm back in the 80s. No, it went forever. I'm back as far back as computers go. That's what year I am in computer-wise. But, I normally have three.
I have nothing. I have an hour's worth of Altair 8000 jokes, so we're we're good.
But I do, so I have to call in on the laptop and do this screen share. Isn't that funny? All right, so I think I can zoom it in.
All right. Ooh, there you go.
Who's got that first question? I wonder who that is. Could it be Teresa Gomez? 404 error question not found. So at least she got it in, though, because she threatened to, like, not do it anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. Is that her making good on the threat? I will tell you, I did the most Andrew thing tonight, which is while waiting for and definitively not prepping for Q&As, I made goat korma. So I
don't know what that means. I barely know what each of those words are. I think I know
korma
what goat is
an Indian curry, and goat is the meat. So I have a big pot of.
Delicious.
It smells great.
I don't think they have Impossible Goat stock yet, going, though. So. There's no Beyond Goat yet.
Impossible Goat would be fantastic.
Yeah, but I love curry. Everything curry
can't
is delicious.
Tastes like real goat.
Yeah. I wouldn't know.
So, Teresa, I will use that as an opportunity to talk about my culinary adventures tonight. Also, I'm drinking Beat It, which is a scotch from the Scotch Appreciation Society. So,
oh,
there we go.
It's not Michael Jackson brand scotch.
It is not Michael Jackson branded scotch, which would be problematic.
Okay. Seth Crownover with the first question. With
real
a bunch
question.
Of, hearts here. Can my idiot governor, Mike Parson, really launch a criminal investigation into a journalist for hitting the view page source button on his shitty Department of Education website? Have you heard about this? I don't know what this is.
I have heard about this story. It's not on the whiteboard, but it is in a Miss Ashley's. So here's the story. I believe it is Missouri. Missouri State put out a web page. I think you said Department of Education. I don't know. The web page, when you click on the view source button, had a bunch of social security numbers, right? And so a journalist was like, you got a real problem with your website here. Yeah. Investigative journalists like went digging to find, you know, what they could about it. And the governor is like, you're a hacker.
Oh,
I want
God.
You charged criminally. I will say this. So we're laughing. I don't think there's any chance that the
Can
journalist
I get
gets
a
charged.
Writ of OK Boomer issued.
Right. We want that. Look, we have talked about this on the show before, but like, many states, right? Like, certainly this is true at the federal level, that like the laws involving like criminal hacking are, you know, were written in the era of the computer you're on right now. Like, you know, Commodore 64, one monitor, like dial up internet. You know, how many times do you try and hack the password? So it is not impossible that there is a criminal possession of computer information statute that you could maybe cram this guy into. But the idea that that's going to happen, I think, is unbelievably.
Would you be able to, in your legal, forget all the whatever shitty boomer statutes we're talking about, but like in your defense, would you be able to say, like, literally it's right click, anybody could do this. This wasn't, you know, like, how would you present that legal defense? Is there anything?
Well, to be honest, that would be, if they went forward, you know, we dismiss this all the time because it gets made into a big deal. But this would be a good example of the limited scenario in which you would go for a jury nullification, right?
Ooh.
You would say, hey, look, we're putting the state to its burden. This is railroading. This is ridiculous. We're going to show you that this is not the kind of thing for which you should prosecute someone. I almost never say that that's the option. But like if it's a strict liability, you know, criminal statute and you meet the criteria for it, that's really kind of your only chance. And it seems like, you know, if you get a decent jury with, you know, only one or two boomers on it, that like, you know, you could win with that argument.
Was it on this channel or somewhere else? Or and Alex, maybe it was my stream. There's some website. Oh, someone remind me what this was. There's a website you can go to where it's like all you do is if you hit any keys on the keyboard, it does like generic hacking text for you. It's so funny. Like it's hilarious to just go there.
Oh, and like you're in a 90s movie. Yeah.
Or every single depiction of hacking ever in any movie of all time or show. Yeah. That's funny. Somebody pointed out to me and I don't remember. It's been a while, so I kept blanking. But anyway, it's really funny. If anyone remembers, throw that out in the chat and I'll tell everybody. Okay. Let's go to Stephen Joseph. How rare is the default judgment which Alex Jones received in Texas? How many are there per year/decade usually?
Very rare. And so let's describe what happened here. This is the total refusal by Alex Jones and his entities to turn over basic documents that were compelled to be produced in the Sandy Hook litigation. So on the one hand, folks have asked, you know, is there precedential value? No, there's nothing because they just defaulted, right? Like eventually what happens is, you know, if the court will send you a sternly worded crunch wrap and then another one and then maybe impose some, you know, contempt and say, well, we're going to fine you, you know, $1,000 until you show up or produce the documents or whatever. But eventually, like if you have manifested an intent not to participate in the litigation, the court will just say, okay, well, we're going to issue a default judgment to the plaintiffs. And so that's what happened here. I have personally never seen it. It with an asterisk, right? Like this is the thing that's super common all the time in small claims court, in evictions court, in right. Like, you know, what happens is, you know, your landlord shows up and you don't. And so you get a default judgment of an eviction. We actually are talking about this on tomorrow's cleanup on aisle 45. It's something that you and I have talked about a lot on the show, and that is there are civil, you know, you have a Gideon v. Wainwright right to an attorney in criminal proceedings. You have a right to a public defender if you can't afford one. You do not have a civil Gideon right.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And there are lots of civil cases, right? You know, eviction notice gets posted on your door, custody hearings, all of that sort of thing that to which you do not have a right to a lawyer. And there was recently a Biden roundtable as part of the Access to Justice initiative that focused in on these kinds of issues. So, you know, again, one of the million points of difference between, you know, where we are now and where we were a year ago. But yeah, so at at that level, at the level at which I do not practice, right, the those kinds of what in Maryland are called district courts, but, you know, your small claims courts, that sort of thing, there are a lot of default judgments. In a case of this size, you never see it, right? Because there's so much going on. What happens is the judge will say, look, you've missed three deadlines. If this happens again, I'm going to default you. And then you don't miss any more fucking deadlines.
Well, so what did happen? I don't understand, because he has good lawyers, doesn't he?
But Alex Jones refused to turn over the documents. And so, look, think about it this way. When you would rather take a default judgment than give them the documents they're asking for, that tells you, right. That tells you what's in those documents. So, it's incredibly rare. Alex Jones is making this, issue of, you know, well, the court is denying me the right to, you know, go before the jury and to, you know, show my side of it. And it's just, that is technically true in the sense that, right, you have had a legal default judgment entered against you, but that was occasioned by his own behavior. So,
yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to go to this question. Sindre, I don't know how I would pronounce that. I'm sorry. Soride something? I'm not sure. But anyway, is the Rittenhouse judge behavior a big problem or a minor one? David points out we covered this, obviously, but I wanted to use this to ask you, any follow-up to that? Did you get any feedback that maybe changed your mind or affected how you view that, or are you pretty much sticking to your guns on that episode?
No, I'm sticking to my guns on that one. I'm really proud of what we did. I know Ezra Klein said that in his experience, you know, in a murder trial, you would call the victim a victim. That strikes me. I mean, again, Ezra Klein, a good faith interlocutor, I would be happy to sit down and chat with him. It strikes me that, right, if you are a prosecutor, you tend to appear in the same court over and over again, right? Because that's, you appear in the court that is in your jurisdiction. There certainly are judges that will allow that kind of language. I'm going to allow it. It characterizes the victim as a carjacker. and so, you know, so if you routinely practiced in front of a judge that that allowed that, yeah, I mean, you'd be a fool as a prosecutor not to take advantage of that. But everything I've seen is that it is a commonplace ruling of law to say, no, you can't call the victims and when the issue is, particularly when the issue is self-defense, when it hasn't been proven. So,
yeah.
So I feel good about our episode. Keep sharing that out. It's we can track kind of the how much interest there is in an episode. And there's a little bit extra interest in that one. That's been a little bit of a blip. So, definitely keep sharing that out.
All right, here we go. Stormy Decisis, always a great questioner.
We love you, Stormy.
People can't be ordered to unhear what they've heard, so telling the jury to disregard information seems performative at best. Why not put the jury in a separate room and pipe in video of the trial on a time delay so they can really be prevented from hearing what they shouldn't? Are there constitutional reasons why not?
There actually are constitutional reasons, and that is the Eighth Amendment? It's either the Sixth or the Eighth Amendment's Confrontation Clause. I'm trying to come up off the top of my head.
It's the Sixth of the Seventh Amendment.
I think it's the Eighth Amendment, but it's the Amendment. It's what gives you the right to confront your 69th accusers.
69th Amendment.
Nice. In any event, you have constitutional
right. That applies
to
the jury, though?
Well, the idea is that the reason you have the right to confront your accuser is because the jury's function is to decide
between
truth,
like, which
right
who
is,
looks
to,
more
is the
white.
Credibility of the witness, right?
Gotcha, yeah.
And there are cases involving, you know, closed circuit TV, and again, usually they are from the perspective of, you know, the defendant or the prosecution, right, arguing either, you know, like, for example, in cases where the victim is a child, like child rape cases, and you put the child on the stand via closed circuit television. Usually those cases are focusing on the right of the defendant versus the protecting the interests of the plaintiff. But I think that it is a short step. I can't say I'm 100% certain, but I think those cases touch on.
But didn't we have the all level kinds of difference of court during COVID that was streamed in various ways?
That was Zoom court. That was streamed 100%. Okay. So it would not surprise me if we see cases teed up where people say, hey, this witness was piped in over Skype, on Zoom, and you didn't get to really see, the fact that they were.
But I wonder if it's a hop, skip, and a jump to like each side gets to prepare their best hype video for their case, and like it's pre-edited videos, like two video presentations based on the trial, like still have the trial, but then you get like one edit, like prosecution edit, defense edit.
One side would get Peter Cullen going, in a world in which the defendant goes first, and the other side would get like Michael Buffer doing, let's get ready to rumble. Anyway.
And really it would be just whichever one you saw last. So I guess nobody would get convicted of anything. Okay, let's go down, check what hearts we see here. This has hearts. I'll see, but I don't know how interesting it is, but don't judge a law book by its cover up.
Nice. Oh, I like it.
A handful of recent episodes with Andrew broadcasting from a boat got me thinking. As much as I love getting new shows as frequently as we do, I also think Thomas deserves a vacation. Thomas, when was the last time you took a vacation? When do you think you'll take another? Well, I think I go, I attend the No Illusions School of Vacationing, which is the last thing that was vacation for me was that trip to New Jersey. I mean, that was amazing. We still produced several episodes of show during that, but that was, that's the best. I mean, that's what I do is, I don't tend to go on month long boat cruises like some hooligans we know, out there on the international waters. Sipping whatever, everything, seeing the sights. But I do, I am seriously, I'll never not be bummed that our Lydia and our New York trip that was planned right before COVID, that got canceled. That was gonna be our first trip without the kids, and we had all these nice tickets and everything. So I'll never not be bummed about that, but we gotta do a makeup of that. And I think Lydia and I are finally, hopefully, gonna travel soon, but we just bought a house, so it's like everything's crazy right now. All right, let's go to the next one that has some hearts here. Okay, here we go. A ton of Dan, Campin Dan, I think, or Campindan, I don't know, but it could be Campin Dan. A ton of dams in this country are privately owned and privately owned and deteriorated. That's such a hard word to say. Deteriorating. The 95-year-old Edenville Dam in Michigan collapsed during a massive rain event, causing millions in property damage after years of regulators warning that its spillways were undersized and had revoked their license to produce electricity years before. I feel like the problem of aging infrastructure on a scale like this and in the wake of climate change is a relatively new question. What legal tools are there for government force individuals to maintain property when failure to do so could result in loss of life and property to others?
That's a super interesting question. And let me say a couple of things, right? The first is I had no idea that there were any dams that were privately owned. In thinking about it, I guess that doesn't surprise me. And so assuming that that is the case, I would think that the first level of remedy would be, right, based in the contract itself, right? Like there's going to be the conveyance of the property is going to be subject to certain conditions. And then, you probably have, ongoing requirements that you may not own the property. It may be leased, right? Like you may own the dam itself, but not the land that it's on. Who knows? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a pin in this question because I think it's really, really interesting.
Yeah. That has Tuesday deep dive written all over it.
Yeah. But and take a look at it and sort of see, what's out there, because in my view, that is It's a really fascinating question. I suspect the answer is breach of contract, but I don't know. So I love that. Great question.
Oh, you know, I'm actually curious about this one. let's go to this. We'll see if you can comment on this. Hey, Arizona support Aaron Lieberman for governor asks, Tom from CogDis has been reading Sagan's A Demon Haunted World for their Patreon subscribers. He's a talented performer, and there's little doubt his rendition is much better than the one available from Audible. Is his performance a copyright violation? Do you think he consulted his attorney? Can you even address this without violating attorney-client privilege?
I cannot answer that question.
Well, I'll answer it. Let's see.
And I would.
Can you give me four possible answers, Andrew?
You, that my co-host, not answer that question.
Andrew, you give and me also, four possible answers, and I will choose two.
And also delete this question from the stream that goes out, or from the.
Now you're just being silly. The fact that a question exists is going
to get you. The question can exist, but seriously, I cannot.
Do we have any updates on the election, by the way?
The question.
Anything?
Yeah.
That question is for you and the entire audience. If they
MSNBC, you know, is showing 5,500 to 2,500 with 1% in, which are all from like, you know, a billion rural counties in Virginia that don't matter. So.
All right. How about this one? Here's a fun one. Jared Novak asks, Andrew, what case from your career are you most proud of?
Ooh.
The case of defending Tom from cognitive dissonance against obvious copyright violations.
Yeah, SOBs from the Sagan estate. No, I'm gonna pick a recent one, and I don't know if Morgan is in the chat, but or Rich, I am most proud of the work that we did in collaboration with the show in getting an amicus brief filed in Michael Flynn's case. I really think we addressed a unique issue. Now again, right? Trump's hand was forced and he was forced to pardon Flynn. So, you know, in the end of it, you know, did that change anyone's minds? You know, I thought, let me say it this way. It was very clear that Trump would have rather not have had to resolve it that way. Right. Mm. So I'm really proud of the work that we did on that.
I'm proud of you for that too. I mean, you just said like, we're going to do this thing. We're going to get, it was amazing to see somebody have a great idea. Like we're going to write a brief and we're going to get cited by the Supreme Court. And then, you know, however long that process was, what, it was a couple months, maybe it took a while to see you go from, we're doing this thing to here, we're writing this thing. We finished this thing. And then, you know, there's a bit of delay and then all of a sudden, bam, we're cited by the Supreme Court. It was very impressive to see you do that. Like, and everybody involved, of course, but like that was such perfect execution of an idea from start to finish. And it went exactly to plan. It was amazing to behold, Andrew. So congrats on that. That is a good one to be proud of.
Thanks.
I still say my brief was better, but that's fine. Neither here nor there.
Neither here nor there.
Oh yeah. Somebody mentioned she's getting ready. So Morgan's probably getting ready for World Series game 6.
Oh,
boy,
yeah.
Talk about a World Series with no one to root for. You got the cheating pieces of shit versus the racist team. Like, I don't, you know, the team, you know, Native American bigotry. I like the team of the Braves, like the people of the Braves, even though they beat the Dodgers. Like, I think it's a cool story. They're a really good team, but they got to be doing that hand chop.
Without, I know, I totally agree.
Yeah, losing their whole outfield. It makes no sense. I mean, I don't know.
Weird. I mean, it's
crazy.
It's crazy, and they have so much great young talent. It would be I am rooting for
Morgan.
Rooting
for them. I'm definitely rooting for the Braves. I'll never root for the Astros in my life again.
Right.
So
yeah, no, that's ridiculous.
All right, here's a fun one. I like this. Right. Originalism is hearsay, and textualism is malicious compliance. That's good. What's with the whole we need you to come down and identify the body thing? Is that just in TV shows? It seems seriously traumatic. Couldn't the coroner just use a picture? I love these questions where it's like, you know, such an obvious thing that we take for granted. So what's going on with that?
Yeah. So again, not my area, so I'm speculating here. But there are two things that you need to do in order to introduce a piece of evidence at trial. The first is you have to maintain the chain of custody over the thing that you're introducing as evidence, right? You have to be able to show that the thing you're bringing to court is the thing that everyone is talking about. Mm. And then the second is you have to establish its provenance, right? Like you have to have somebody who knows what it is say what it is. So the problem with sending a picture is I could send you a picture and then swap out the body for something else, mm-hmm. right? So what you want to do is you want to bring somebody down and say, all right, you know, this is the body. I want you to observe it has, you know, tag number 6342 on the toe.
Really? That's the part they don't really say in the shows, you know?
Again, I'm speculating. I've never done, but this is how I would do it if I were trying a murder based on, you know, civil trials all the time. Like you have pieces of physical evidence that you want to get in and you need to establish that, like, you haven't swapped it out, right? And I mean, think about this in, you know, criminal cases. Think about this in the OJ trial, right? Like, you know, if you're accusing the cops of fabricating evidence, right? Like, it would be super easy to just be like, oh yeah, well, we took this body and then, you know, did X, Y, and Z to it. And so this way, you know, you would bring them down, they would identify it. You would say, here's the toe tag. You would say, here's the procedure that guarantees that no one, you know, can get in and access the body in between after you've identified it and when we go to trial so that we know that it's still the same piece of evidence. So that's my
Because in the shows, they're like, we need you to come down and have a dramatic scene that maybe will be your Oscar winner with worthy material or Emmy Look your loved one in the face for some reason. And then that's what it is in movies. It's funny.
Yeah.
Or to end Law and Order. All right. Let's go to the next question here. Oh, no, that's the same one. Same person. Okay. Originalism is hearsay and textualism is malicious compliance. Again, asks, my understanding is that ignorance of the law is not a defense, but is that always true? What if a law is so obscure, confusing, bizarre, etc., that no reasonable person could have suspected their behavior was illegal? I love this question.
I love it, too. This is like a first-year law school kind of question, right? Like these are the sorts of things you start talking about at a big picture level when you are young and idealistic and kind of talking about general principles. And it's a rule of law principle, right? The idea is the two axes of the rule of law are no crime without a law and no law that is not public and widely available, right? Like, so, you know, you can't have, you violated secret law X, right? That imperfectly translates to the real world, in which, some laws, some criminal laws, some crimes have scienter requirements, right? We've talked about that, that require you to have a particular mens rea, a particular state of mind. And some are strict liability crimes. Mm-hmm. And again, the classic example of that I think most people are okay with having as a strict liability crime, you know, possession of child pornography, mm-hmm. right? Like you don't have to do the, like, did you know? It's just, nope, mm-hmm. we've got the hard drive.
But in a liability one, maybe the complexity of the law could be a mens rea defense. Like, oh, how could I have intended to break this law if I don't even understand it?
that's right. Although, remember that the test for criminal mens rea, I just want to make sure that we don't have law students, you know, who get misled by this or, you know, bombard me with Andrew was wrong, which they love to do. The standard for mens rea is, did you intend to do the thing that you did that broke the law, right? And so that is the case, right? You don't have to intend to break the law.
Gotcha.
You just have to intend the action.
Okay.
And you intend the foreseeable consequences of your actions. So things like, well, I got really, really drunk, and I'm not that sure what happened after that. Well, did you intend to get really, really drunk, right? Now, if you were, you know, Mickey'd, right? If you were drinking from a bottle of Gatorade and somebody had cut that with vodka and you didn't realize it, that might be a defense. But if you were deliberately drinking vodka and Gatorade, you're on the hook for whatever you did in your vodka and Gatorade fueled nightmare. Not that that's ever happened to me. There is that lack of overlap. I would say at the extreme, if a law is indecipherable, if there's no way to conform your conduct to the law, then you have a defense of impossibility, right? You have to say, you can say, there's nothing I could have done to have conformed my conduct to this law.
Right. I imagine with how bad lawmakers are at writing laws, I'm sure are there cases where there's like contradictory laws? So it's like damned if you do, damned if you don't. Like either way, you're – yeah.
Yep, absolutely. And again, in those cases, what happens is you – the burden of proof shifts, right? So once the state proves that you did the thing that violated the law, then the burden shifts to you to raise as an affirmative defense something like – a legal justification, right? To say, right, but I was complying with law X, right? Mm-hmm. And so, look, that's going on right now in the context of, mask mandates, right? Like if somebody says, you know, hey, you assaulted me throwing me out of the store, it would then be an affirmative defense to say, right, because you came into my store without a mask on and lie down on the floor like a baby and started kicking your feet.
Weren't there those nut job, I don't know, mayors or governor, whoever the hell, who was like, I'm banning mask mandates. And then like at other levels, they're like, no, you can't, you know, so that would be a good defense. I feel like if you're like, well, I don't know what takes precedence. I'm just the average guy. How do I know? I mean, you should just be wearing a mask, but I'm saying like that's a hypothetical person.
Wear the fucking mask. Yeah.
All right. We've got this one's a little involved. I got to say, this is a new one for Q&A. Oops, the wrong thing. Here we go. But it's got 13 hearts, Andrew. So I think we need to do it. David Bax, Spino Breaker asks, roll a six sided die. Do you have one on you, Andrew? If not, I can computer one, I think.
I do not have a six-sided die on me.
I'll computer one for you, I guess.
Okay.
If you roll a one, tell a story. Tell a story from your holiday. One is about the boat. Two is about the food. Uh-huh. Three is about somewhere you went. Four is about the alcohol you enjoyed. Five is something insane and random. And six is something that dragged you back to the real world. Here, I think you can just Google roll a six-sided die. Six-sided die, and I will tell you what it says to me. Here we go. It says, rolling three. Okay, so what was three? Let's see, go back to it. About somewhere you went.
Oh, somewhere you went. Okay, so I can do this, and it will also overlap with some of the other fun stuff. Prior to getting on the transatlantic cruise to come back, which was a lot of fun, not something I've ever done before. It was really great. One of the things I love the most about that was that to get on the boat, you had to show your proof of vaccination. You had to instantly, right? There was a half hour wait where you took a nasal swab test. They swabbed you like a couple of days out at sea. Like they had an entire deck set off to quarantine. So, you know, there was also some self-selection bias, right? And like, as I'm meeting people on the boat and telling them what I do, I could do the like, you know, one of my favorite lines, which is, you know, yeah. So I started this law show and then, you know, my country elected a criminally insane game show host as president. And I could do that with relative confidence that I was not going to find any Trump supporting knuckle draggers, because you know, if you were an anti-vax person, you probably wouldn't want to get on a boat that makes you vax to get on. Anyway, so where did I go before I got on the boat? We spent a week in San Sebastian, Spain, which is in Basque country, right on the border between Spain and France.
We can't stop here. The north. This is Basque country. That'll be funny to like five people. It's fine.
It's not funny to me, but I'm laughing. And that is super cool because it is like it's the same feeling, and there are Basque separatists, right, that of like going to Montreal, and like there are just these pockets of like, you know, Francophiles that you know, that speak French and that are really like feel like they're separate from the rest of Canada. And like the Basque people that I met like were super proud of their, you know, cultural identity. Their language was everything was bilingual, Basque and Spanish, which was kind of a challenge for me in my high school Spanish. Basque language has like X's every other letter. It's really cool.
Oh, interesting.
And their culture is just super, their food, their tourist facing culture, I should say. Like I did not, you know, ethnographically get into it. They have they have a great way of, welcoming tourists. They serve, a white wine called Chacolina, which is cloudy. So they pour like this long pour of wine. It's really theatrical. And then if you're there at lunch, like they'll hand you the bottle, they cut a little notch in the cork. And then it's like, well, here you go, asshole, like good luck pouring refills. And I got to about like 80% on being able to do the, long pour on refills at lunch. Hmm. So, delicious, like, you know, kind of high acidity white wine. So I use that to kind of get a lot of the separate questions.
I was going to say, you're going to cover that. 1 through 6. Like that'll be, that's the Andrew way.
That was my lightning way. Right,
better cover every single number. No.
There we go. All right.
Here's one that's bound to stir controversy, probably. Ooh. Skeptics in the pub online, it's like offline, but online. In the online leftist circles, there's a notion that Biden can just cancel student debt and that he doesn't need anyone, Manchin, for example, to agree with him to just do it. How wrong or right are they? How can the president go about canceling student debt? Do we not do a show on this? I swear, I feel like I asked you, like, we got to do a show on whether or not we can do this, and now I don't remember if we did.
Yeah, we have not done a full show on that. We should do a full show.
I feel
on
like
that.
Liz Warren thinks he can just do it.
So let's cabin out the things that he can't do, right? So first, this can only apply to government loans, right? It cannot apply to private loans, which are a significant source of student debt. Secondly, it then becomes a question of to what extent does the executive branch have the power to not enforce contracts? And that's never been tested, as far as I know, at the level that Democratic activists are talking about, right? Like, so it is clear, for example, that like the governor of a state can say, we have a contract with you, you know, Thomas Smith Company, to repave our roads. You didn't repave our roads. We could sue you for $1 million. But you know what? We're going to just abolish that, right? We're going to say, all right, you don't owe us the money anymore. Right. You can forgive a single contract example. Is there an analytical difference between a single example and the entirety of privately held student debt? I feel like you could make that argument.
Yeah.
So that's that way of saying I definitely think we should do a deep dive on it. And again, I just want to point out a reason to proceed. So I want to point out two things here. Number one, my understanding is that, and again, I know our like hard left listeners are going to roll their eyes and go, yeah, all Biden does is study stuff. But I have had folks tell me that like that is a real item of study by the Biden administration, right? That it really is a question that they are pursuing to see what the legal strength is for them to do that. And a reason to proceed expeditiously is what happens if that's indeterminate, right? Like if you tell a bunch of people like, hey, your student loan is canceled. And then let's say what happened, what we want to have happen is a bunch of millennials go, okay, great. I've been paying $2,700 a month in student loans, I'm now finally going to go buy a house, right, mm-hmm. and incur a $2,700 mortgage. And then all of a sudden, you know, 6 months later, you know, there's a final court ruling that says, oh, no, wait, we're uncanceling that. Like, that could be disastrous.
I got a question. Who has standing to challenge that? Is it just boomers who are like, we're challenging because we're victims of millennials being able to actually afford things, and that goes against everything we stand for?
Would you have taxpayer standing? You might have taxpayer standing. Yeah. If you have a third-party institution that is servicing those loans, right? Like, you know, you might have that. So I don't know that you're going to get out on standing. And again, I am for this, right? Like, I feel like every time when we talk about how, you know, it's a little more complicated than some on the far left would like it to be, you know, we get 500 people quit their patronage, and we get a ton of emails of like, you guys are centrist hacks. Like, I am for canceling student debt. What I'm not for is and I always use this same example, right? Like, think about the equivalent of the Trump Muslim ban, right? Like, it's a horrible policy. We said right out front, yeah, Trump has the legal authority to do this. He did. It took him an extra 2.5 years to get it done because of how incompetently it was done in the first place. And so I think it is worth knowing what the actual law is before you you say, like, well, let's just do X, because this could really hurt people who rely on it and think that the debt's been canceled, and all of a sudden an injunction gets entered and no, it isn't.
Yeah. I wonder if this is something to do closer to midterms. Let's see. Backtracking here through the questions. No Name asks, I've heard you all say that district and appellate judges really don't want to be overruled by higher courts because that can hurt their chances for advancement. But aren't Brett and Amy some of the most overturned judges currently practicing? Despite Breyer's statements, isn't it all virtue signaling now?
Okay, I'm not sure I understand the premise of the question, because when I say overturned, I mean overturned by a higher court to mm-hmm. which you aspire to be on. I do not think, I mean, Amy Coney Barrett was a judge for like 7 minutes. So,
yeah.
And Brett Kavanaugh, as we said, in contrast to Neil Gorsuch, wrote incredibly measured, boring, thoughtful opinions while on the DC circuit because he's been groomed to be on the Supreme Court, and that's been his lifelong dream for the last 30 years. So I don't think they compiled that record when they were lower court judges. Mm. And I think the question is then saying, oh, but they're in the minority at the Supreme Court. I do not say that Supreme Court judges are afraid of being in the minority. That is very plainly not the case. So I think you're conflating. Maybe I don't understand the premise of the question, but I think you're conflating being overruled by a higher court versus being in the minority on the court that you're on. And I would say that those are two different things. You've made it to the promised land when you're on the Supreme Court. So.
Okay. Let's see. I'm digging, digging down for questions. Okay, here, let's try this one. Mesner asks, I understand why inherent contempt as it exists today will never be used by Congress because of all the reasons legal analysts have noted about it, but going forward, assuming they are supposed to continue to be a co-equal branch, should Congress have an inherent ability to enforce subpoenas? If so, what can Congress create, a law, policy, exorbitant fines, to ensure its subpoenas will be enforced without having to use a different branch to do it for them? You nodded along for the listeners on inherent contempt will never be used by Congress. I don't remember that story. What is that?
Why so, not? And this I think is related to, Steve Bannon flouting a subpoena, right? And so what happened was that the House referred Steve Bannon to the Department of Justice for prosecution. He has not yet been prosecuted. I believe that he will be. And I believe that if he's not, and if that decision does not come down in a reasonable period of time, that is, by the way, a valid reason, a valid criticism against Attorney General Merrick Garland, right? Like the Bannon case is just open and shut. He flaunted the law. It's a crime. And let's have some guys with guns show up at his house and be like, yeah, you're going to obey the law like everybody else, asshole. Mm-hmm. So the question is, again, having not been done since 1938, instead of Congress referring Steve Bannon to the DOJ for criminal prosecution, couldn't they just have the House Marshal go out and enforce the subpoenas? That, again, as we've said on the show, they certainly could. But I agree with the premise of the question that the age of that happening is probably over. The second part of the question was, assuming that that's over, what can Congress do to ensure enforcement?
Yes, to still have somebody listen to their fucking subpoenas.
Yeah, it there are a couple of things there, right? That I would explore that would be sort of two different levels of hardball, right? The first would be a jurisdiction stripping that says federal courts do not have the power to rule on congressional subpoenas. Only, you know, a subcommittee of Congress has the power to rule on congressional subpoenas. That would be sort of
what would that do? Would it reduce the amount of stalling that they can do, or?
Yeah, it would. Well, it would say that the the questions over enforcement would remain within the House. If you didn't want to go that far, you could create a separate court. Right. You could say, right, in the same way you could create an Article III court and say, you know, we're going to refer these kinds of questions not to the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, but this separate, you know, congressional subpoena court. And that, you know, would at least, be different than the process that we have now. But look, I agree with you that the system is broken, and I'm surprised because it is such an important part of congressional power, right? Like the ability to conduct investigations is a key part of what Congress does, the House of Representatives does. Mm-hmm. And so I am surprised that more members of Congress are not upset at this.
Any updates on the election? Again, we could check in with it.
26% in. We've got Youngkin 52.4. No, Youngkin 52.3 and McAuliffe 47. What they are showing right now, Steve Kornacki is showing Loudoun County, which I totally agree. Loudoun County is a Northern Virginia county with 77% in, is showing McAuliffe 53, Youngkin 46.5. And if that is the margin, then Youngkin will have won this governorship. Wow. Now the 23% that's out, I assume are early voting, and could that be 95-5 Democratic, right? Could that ultimately wind up going for McAuliffe by 20 points? It could, right? But yeah, if you're only leading, if you're a Democrat and you're only leading by 6 in Northern Virginia, and again, now that's not Fairfax, but you know, that's he's showing next to it, Biden won it by 25 points, right? 61-36 over Trump. So, I remind folks, like, Maryland has a Republican governor. At the state level, states can be reliably Democratic for federal office, and still, you know, kind of evaluate their governors on a case by case basis. This does not surprise me that this is a close election. It will not surprise me if we lose this race.
Yikes. Source code in the chat. Can you please lot awful movies? True Believer with Robert Downey Jr. and right wing wacko James Woods. Don't know anything about it, but
I don't know that either. Promising.
Is anybody, is it an actual law movie? True Believer. Can't wait to find out. All right. Let's a little fun one to, you know, forget about this election woes here. Meth rhinos are people, my friend, asks, do those signs on dump trucks that say stay back 200 feet, not responsible for broken windshields, actually have any legal force? Surely one is always responsible for the shit that falls out of their vehicles, no matter what signs you slap on your truck.
Yeah, this is the answer to all of those signs, right? Any sign related question, solicitors forbidden, you know, angry hippo on cocaine on premises, you know, stuff like that. So the answer is twofold. Number one, no, it does not magically immunize you from liability. But what it does do is it comes into play in terms of negligence, in terms of with the dump truck, like the reason to put that on there is to win if it's a contributory negligence state, or to increase the amount of comparative negligence to say, look, the truck says it's full of, like, you know, exploding anvils. And this guy, you know, stay back 200 feet. And this guy was within 30 feet. So, yeah, we are we did everything we could to strap down the exploding anvils. It doesn't obviate the negligence of the dump truck driver, but it's meant to make an argument to increase the comparative negligence of the plaintiff. Now there is also an argument at the margins that says we did every reasonable behavior we could, including informing people. So, you know, it might play into an argument of no breach of duty, but it's much more, you know, to say, hey, look, they can't, because think about it. If you just had a dump truck, right, and I'm driving the way I would behind any other normal truck, mm-hmm. right? I can say, well, I didn't know what the hell was in the dump truck. I'm just driving safely and normally. And a jury would be like, yep, that's 0% responsibility, as opposed to, you know, it's emblazoned on the back. Stay back. It's full of exploding anvils, whatever.
Exploding anvils.
I don't know why I came up with that one, but that's what I'm sticking with. It's easier to argue in front of the jury that, like, come on, that the plaintiff's conduct was, you know, contributorily negligent here.
All right, let's see. I went down to the bottom because we're in the lightning round officially with a few minutes left here. Stormy Decisis asks, if I, like so many of my students, took a copyrighted piece of writing and substituted a synonym for every word, would that be a violation of copyright? Oh, man, I love it.
I love that question. I know where it comes from, right? Which is to say, the plagiarism. Yeah. Well, yeah. But the plagiarism rules. Sorry, it comes from Stormy Decisis, but also the academic plagiarism rules, right? Protect kind of the core of the idea. Mm. I don't know. I mean, sort of. So phrasing it that way suggests that it might not be a violation of copyright. We know, right, that you cannot have a copyright in an idea. If what you did was, you know, for everything that's not a and the, it's right. Like, I'm like a, you know, going, it was the, you know, superlative of occurrences.
The goodest of periods. It was the baddest of periods.
Is there a real argument that, like, that's not a copyright violation? That, like, you have not appropriated, right, the heart of what makes that memorable. And certainly, right, every test I know on copyright focuses on, I mean, it's right there in the word, but focuses on copy, right? Mm. Like that's why one of the things that is a defense to copyright that isn't a defense to trademark, we talked about this on the show last time, is independent creation, right? Like if you own the Golden Arches, doesn't matter if, you know, you were living in a bunker, you know, somewhere and you independently came up with the idea of a big yellow M. The question is, when you put it up to sell hamburgers, does that cause a likelihood of confusion? With copyright, if you independently create the exact same thing as someone else, that's a defense. Now, again, right? Right. So jurors are not hard. You know, judges and juries find it very easily. Like one of the elements in
lightning round.
Yeah, bring your copyright claim is access, right? The work, you have to show that the work has been published, and if the work has been published, then you know the likelihood that the defendant had access to it, from which you can infer, you know, you didn't just accidentally write. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Yeah. All right, I'll stop so we can do.
I'd like to begin my lightning round answer with Federalist 53. Let's go through the premises.
I did that once.
Now here's maybe a quick procedural one here. Fred Bremer asks, can any extra good stuff make it into a bill during reconciliation between House and Senate versions, or do they only reduce the new law to match the least interesting version? Can you end up with extra stuff during reconciliation?
My understanding is that you can wind up with extra stuff, and also keep in mind, right, that the full, I believe I'm right on this, but the full Build Back Better Act passed the House already, right? Like that's not, we have the ability to schedule, and they scheduled a vote on HR, you know, was it 5387? So you're already working with the large version in terms of what gets pushed through the Senate. So two answers to that. A, we could definitely have something above and beyond just the framework if, you know, enough senators change their mind between now and the end of the year. And number two, in terms of could you go even beyond that, I think, put an asterisk by this, but I think there is, it's up to the parliamentarian to sort of say, was this germane to, you know, kind of essentially what was passed? Because that happens all the time, that like, you know, the bill that passes Congress will say, the bill that passes the House will say, yes, you enforce this through A, and the bill that passes the Senate will say, yes, you enforce this through B. And then in reconciliation, in ordinary reconciliation, they'll be like, all right, the Senate won't vote for A, the House won't vote for B. Let's just agree to change both our versions to C, right? Mm. And the parliamentarians will be like, yeah, right, it technically wasn't any, but like it's close enough. So,
and those sorry, are my I was two reading answers. A question for the beginning, so I sorry if I missed That's this, fine. But this is just to avoid it. Isn't it to avoid another vote? Because I'm pretty sure if you do reconciliation and it changes enough, don't they have to re-vote on it or something? And that's how it works? So you could introduce new stuff?
Okay. Yeah. And that's, and again, that's a parliamentarian issue.
So the parliamentarians deciding, is this close enough to where we don't have to go through an entire vote or not? Okay. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
All right. Last question. This is an interesting one. GCU Problem Child asks, are you at all worried about establishing some kind of dangerous precedent if you say invading a government building is an attempted insurrection? Recently, I've heard some far leftists saying stuff like, yeah, January 6th was terrible, but what if next time some left-wing protesters do a sit-in in City Hall and the GOP says that's insurrection? What do you think about that?
I like the premise of the question, right? I like the idea of let's make sure we're establishing a rule that is appropriate both ways. I think that the dividing line is this, and I understand that this gets sort of perilously close to some Occupy tactics, but I think when you stop Congress from engaging in official activity, like that's where it crosses the line. And that's why, right, I have been a defender. I know there are folks out there on our side of the aisle who want, you know, each and every one of these 400 cases, you know, to get the death penalty or what have you. The DOJ has basically said, if you breached into the Capitol, but you did not go out into the well of the Senate or further, you know, across that the velvet rope or whatever, that they are agreeing to, you know, plea bargaining with just probation with no time. And I think that's probably right for purposes of the question, right? That like that the folks that we want to worry about are the people who were there to prevent it. The core of the insurrection was not being in the Capitol. The core of the insurrection was being in the Capitol with the intent of stopping Congress from doing a thing that it had to do that day.
Various weaponry and all the kinds of other,
right.
Actually beating officers with flags. I mean, I agree. A couple things. First off, have we already forgotten that this doesn't matter? This already happens. You know, in my amicus brief that curiously didn't make its way through the Supreme Court, I think I brought up the example of that guy who, like, what did he do? He, like, I don't know, lit a trash can or something during protests, and he's in prison for 8 years or something. I mean, left leaning people are, you know, however you want to say it, like non right wing insurrectionists get charged with crap like this all the time. And I guess the other thing I was going to say is that, like, it is called civil disobedience for a reason. I mean, I think that in a good protest where you are just saying, look, we're making a point here, we're delaying, you're obviously not macing Congress people and hopefully not committing violence against Congress people, and you truly are just doing a sit-in or something. Well, yeah, maybe you probably do still get arrested, and who knows what level of charge there would be. I think that that is part of the cost of doing these things sometimes. And then it's up to, I don't know, prosecutors, if they want to, you know, how much they want to pursue that, I guess.
The civil disobedience point is an excellent point. I want to echo it and say, I'm mad I didn't think to say that.
All right. Well, that's all the time that we have. I'm glad we're back at it. And Andrew is no longer on a boat, so he can be live with us and we can see his hole punched wall and his TV and, that I think is discolored because he still has the green screen effect on in his background. I'm not sure.
I think that's probably right. I turned around twice. So I turned around once when it put projection and I could see looking at my monitor, which had the TV in the background. And that was just a projection of, you know, no call in New Jersey. The latest news on Virginia governor's race is too close to call. But the margin has expanded out to 55.5, 44. This is really, it seems pretty clear to me, that it is going to come down to, you know, counting, early, right? Like this is going to be another blue shift. And if we pull it out, you know, we're going to have the same situation, that we had with the presidential election. And right. Like that the idea that it is going to become a permanent fixture of our landscape, that, you know, Republicans either win, at which point it's fine, or they lose, at which point the election was stolen. Mm-hmm. That's a terrifying.
Yep. That's terrifying idea now.
And if that doesn't motivate you to go out and vote Democratic, I don't know what will.
Yeah. So. I don't know. All right. Well, thanks so much, patrons, for the questions and everybody for joining. We love you so much. And looking forward to getting back on the old schedule with a lot of awful movies and all that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We'll see you for, I guess, Rapid Response Friday.
Hey, I hope everybody loved Cocaine Hippos. So.